Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. Before we proceed, I'm very delighted to take this opportunity to introduce Susie Antunian, who's vice president of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, and is representing Council President Jane Wales, who unfortunately was called out of town immediately last night on an emergency. Jane?
Good evening. I would also like to welcome everybody to tonight's program on the U.S. War on Terrorism, Myths and Realities, sponsored by the Independent Institute and co-sponsored by Harper's Magazine and the World Affairs Council of Northern California. The World Affairs Council aims to engage people in the exploration of issues and opportunities that transcend borders. To learn more about the Council and our diverse programs, please visit our website at itsyourworld.org. I would like to commend the Independent Institute for having done a wonderful job in organizing today's event. Tonight's program features Lewis Lapham, editor of Harper's Magazine and author of the new book, Theater of War. Following Mr. Lapham, we will have a discussion with a panel of distinguished journalists. They are Alan Bach, senior editorial writer, Orange County Register, Jonathan Marshall, former editorial page editor of the Oakland Tribune, Seth Rosenfeld, staff writer of the San Francisco Chronicle, and Paul Weaver, former Washington bureau chief of Fortune magazine. As you well know, there is much to discuss as world events and the prospects of war loom large these days. I will now turn the program to David Thoreau so that we can get started. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susie. The Independent Institute regularly sponsors the Independent Policy Forum, a series of lectures, debates, and seminars held here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We began a series of programs after 9/11 that were intended to examine some of the key issues involved in the conflict and the many, you might say, contentious matters that are at hand. In your printed program, please note that our next event will feature the renowned Pentagon official and whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, who will be speaking on secrecy, freedom, and empire based on his very important new book entitled Secrets. In all of our programs, we seek to get beyond left and right and feature speakers who present their own views so that we all have a better opportunity to make up our own minds. For those of you who are new to the Independent Institute, we're a public policy research institute located here in the Bay Area. We sponsor and publish comprehensive studies of major issues, and we conduct many conference and media programs based on that. Please also visit our website at independent.org for further information on our programs, including our books, our quarterly journal. This is a copy of the current issue called The Independent Review. And also, we encourage you to subscribe to our free email newsletter called The Lighthouse, which you can do so on the homepage. James Madison, the master builder of the U.S. Constitution, noted that, quote, "If tyranny and oppression come to this land, it will be in the guise of fighting a foreign enemy," unquote. Indeed, President Bush now calls for a new foreign policy of unlimited, unilateral, and first strike intervention against all countries that might someday threaten U.S. supremacy. While those responsible for 9/11 remain at large, we now face the prospects of a war in Iraq and elsewhere, combined domestically with the Orwellian USA Patriot Act, TIPS domestic spying program, Department of Homeland Security, incarcerations without charge or trial, militarized law enforcement and airport security, national ID cards, and growing port protectionism and corporate welfare. Our speaker this evening has long been an insightful critic of human folly, especially that of war, and the interest groups who feed off it. This evening, we seek to facilitate a better discussion of the U.S. war on terrorism. So I'd like to welcome all of our participants. And if you'd please hold your applause until I complete the introductions. A San Francisco native, Lewis Lapham became editor of Harper's Magazine in 1971, having worked for the San Francisco Examiner and the New York Herald Tribune. The author of many books, he received the 1995 National Magazine Award for his Harper's Column Notebook. Mr. Lapham has been the host of two PBS series, and for those of you who have not seen this new book, it's called Theater of War, and here's a copy. As Susie mentioned, our panel of journalists includes Alan Bach of the Orange County Register, also a columnist for antiwar.com. He's the author of the books Waiting to Inhale, The Politics of Medical Marijuana, The Ecology Action Guide, and Ambush at Ruby Ridge. Next to him, Jonathan Marshall is former economics editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. The recipient of many awards in journalism, he's the author of numerous books on foreign affairs, including the books Drug Wars, The Iran-Contra Connection, and Cocaine Politics. Next to him, Seth Rosenfeld from the San Francisco Chronicle won a landmark 17-year legal battle under the Freedom of Information Act, forcing the FBI to release 200,000 pages of documents about its covert activities at the University of California to disrupt the free speech movement and other activities. Finally, Paul Weaver has been an editor with Fortune Magazine and the Public Interest, a professor at Harvard University, and a public affairs officer at Ford Motor Company. Among his books are News and the Culture of Lying and The Suicidal Corporation. Please join me in welcoming our participants. A couple of quick program format matters before we begin. After the discussion, we'll have questions from the audience. On the card in your printed program, please simply jot down your question during the presentations, and there'll be ushers circulating the aisles to pick them up. After the question period, we'll adjourn also, and Mr. Lapham will be available to autograph his book in the front outer lobby. Now I'm most pleased to present Lewis Lapham.
I am honored and greatly to be here. As you know, I'm from San Francisco, and it gives me great joy to come back to this city and to talk to so many people. I thank you for coming. I've written over the last year quite a lot about our ongoing war against terrorism, and it's hard to know where to start. It is, of course, a war against an unknown enemy and an abstract noun. And we do know that shortly after 9/11, 2001, Mr. Rumsfeld explained that it was a war that could last for 30 or 40 years or maybe forever. It's like a war against, well, it is. It's the war against all the world's evildoers. It's like the war on drugs, or the war on poverty, or the war on lust, or the war on pride. It never ends. And it, from the point of view of Washington, I think one of the things that we've learned in the last year or so has been the distance between the military and foreign policy establishment in Washington and what we can now call the American street. In other words, I don't find, despite what the polls say, I never trust the polls anyway, but I don't find broad, eager sentiment for the war on terrorism or for the forthcoming invasion of Iraq. The magazine has dissented over the last 12 months, and our newsstand sale has been going steadily up. Not a lot of this opinion seems to show up in the mainstream media. And I begin to think that from the point of view of the military foreign policy establishment in Washington, the attack on the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon can be seen as a blessing in disguise. No cloud without a silver lining, because consider what has happened. The attack rescued the presidency of George W. Bush in August of 2001. The economy was beginning to fall into decline. The Republicans had lost control of the Senate. The only accomplishment that Bush had to his credit was the tax cut that benefited a very small and wealthy percentage of the population. The conservative compassion of the campaign of 2000 was looking not very compassionate. And suddenly, and it was possible to confuse Bush with an ornament of the American corporate plutocracies, along the lines of a prize fish on a country club wall. Within a matter of days after the attack, he is suddenly pronounced the peer of Lincoln and Churchill. These are the remarks of the Washington Post and the columnists in the New York Times. But also, within another 6 weeks, we have the passage of the USA Patriot Act put forward by Ashcroft, who is our Attorney General, and who believes and who has said that in the United States we have no king but Jesus. And he, as you know, he begins his meetings every morning at the Justice Department with people standing around in a circle of prayer, holding hands, and singing songs of the Attorney General's own composition. And these songs are available on the internet. You can actually, I promise you, they are frightening to listen to. But we have the Patriot Act, and I'm sure most of you in this room understand the seizure of police powers on the part of the government. That essentially, the government can now open anybody's mail, tap anybody's phone, search anybody's premises without a warrant. And we've had two reorganizations. That bill, by the way, passed through both houses of Congress with very few hours of debate. And we've also had two reorganizations of the FBI in the last 12 months, in each reorganization improving upon the authoritarian prerogatives implicit in the Patriot Act. The other blessing, of course, has been for the military budget. We now have, with terrorism and terrorists and Hussein, and an enemy to take the place of the old Soviet Union. For many years, in my entire memory, the country has been at war. I can remember as a child in San Francisco, World War II. I can remember the ships in the bay, and I can then remember this, the very quick segue into the Cold War, into the national security state, into heavier and heavier emphasis on secrecy and on security, more and more money being spent, our greatest store of treasure on our arsenal. I can even I could say that our greatest artworks are our armaments, our missiles. They are the equivalent of the Chartres Cathedral or the Sistine Ceiling. We lavish enormous intelligence, imagination, money on these demonic weapons. We also have had, I also, as I'm sure everybody in this room also has lived under the fear, threat of nuclear annihilation for the last 50-odd years. I remember internalizing that fear during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when the missiles were supposedly en route from Cuba. But again, the whole notion of the country at war, the notion that war is the health of the state, a phrase coined by Randolph Bourne in the early part of the century, is true. And now that we have the war on terrorism and the notion that we can, the doctrine of preemptive action, forward deterrence, committing us to God knows what kind of military response at any point in the world is now. You could have said that the Soviet Union was as necessary to the American economy as General Motors or Iowa corn. And it begins to look as if we can say the same thing about the war on terrorism. But of course, we have to sell it we can't say that quite. We can't say that that it is such a naked commercial or political or hegemonic purpose. So we have to present it as a crusade. And President Bush has been doing that for a year, drawing the line in the sand between good and evil, an axis of evil discovered in the State of the Union address last January. And his language is religious. He sounds almost as if he is a medieval pope summoning the faithful to again, never-ending war with the infidel. And this is backed up in the language of Ashcroft and in the language of quite a few of the people who are close to Rumsfeld and Cheney in the Defense Department. And what strikes me is the lack of dissent. We don't seem to have very many voices in Congress arguing against the juggernaut or trying to find what the real reasons are for our forthcoming invasion of Iraq. I listened to President Bush's speech at the UN on September 12th, and although I could see that it was persuasive to some of our European allies and possibly to some of our more friendly Muslim states in the Middle East, certainly it appealed to the editorial writers in the Times and the Post, but I found nothing in the speech convincing or making the case for making the argument for war. And then I remembered Donald Rumsfeld at a press conference, NATO press conference last June in Brussels, and he was being asked by some of the European reporters to come up with reasons or proofs or how are we doing with the war on terrorism and so on. And he assured them that there were many reasons, close at hand, top secret, not to be trusted to mere journalists. And then he went on to say that you have to remember that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So, under those rules, the war can last forever, and we all can be sent to jail. And I honestly don't understand why more of the Democrats in Congress aren't arguing the point or making fun of ridiculing some of the positions of the administration. I am distressed by the contempt with which Rumsfeld and Cheney address not only the American media, but the American people. And I'm surprised that that doesn't arouse more anger. Another example. 2 weeks ago, I think it was 2 weeks ago, at Camp David, Bush was there with Tony Blair, the Briton, and he held up a photograph of what purported to be a online nuclear weapons facility in Iraq, and then went on to quote a report by the International Atomic Energy Commission saying that this photograph represented a working facility and was close to or capable of making a nuclear bomb. And this was offered in evidence. And within 2 hours of that demonstration on television, the International Atomic Energy Commission pointed out that, A, the photograph was 4 years old. Two, that what was attributed to the report by the International Atomic Energy Commission was a complete distortion. The commission had never said that. There was no way that Hussein possessed the means or the capability to make a weapon. And the only report of that contradiction on the part of the International Atomic Energy Commission that I saw was in the Financial Times, a British newspaper. I never saw in any of the American papers. It may have been there, but I didn't see it in the Times or in the Washington Post. So it's similar to what happened in 1990 during the buildup to the first war against Saddam Hussein, when a satellite photograph was, the part of the pretext for the war was the amassing of Iraqi tanks on the border of Saudi Arabia, soon to be unleashed against the oil fields and against Riyadh. And this was one of the reasons for our intervention. The photograph, which was acquired through an independent source, a French satellite imaging company was acquired by the St. Petersburg Times, and the photograph showed there were no tanks. That photograph appeared only in the St. Petersburg Times. It was offered to the networks, it was offered to the major newspapers, but they, because it was not a government handout, because it had not been given to them by the Pentagon, they didn't print it. And we now, of course, we have a media that is largely, is the entertainment business. And the Pentagon learned one lesson in Vietnam, which was not to let the cameras or the reporters get too close to the news. They could get within 5 miles, posed on the roof, tasteful wardrobe, desert, tan, burning buildings in the background, but that was it. And so our news correspondents, the ABC newspaper, news correspondents cannot get very close to the whatever is going on in Afghanistan. However, ABC is owned by Disney, and Disney hired Jerry Bruckheimer, who's a movie producer, who produced Top Gun and Black Hawk Down, to make an 18-part series called The War in Afghanistan, and to make it with the assistance of the Pentagon, and to present it as and that will be presented as news on ABC television. So dissent is essential. Democracy depends on candor. It depends on people saying what they think, what they know, counting on their fellow citizens to respond in kind. That we try to tell each other the truth. That's what makes democracy work. And I'm afraid that what we're seeing here toward the beginning of the 21st century is the decay of the Democratic Republic and the rise of, I don't know what the people in Washington like to refer to it as, the new American Empire. And you read commentary like that in the neoconservative press, a lot of the mainstream journals. I had a wonderful quote. Yeah, this is Charles Krauthammer in Time magazine, and it's a remark that can be taken as representative of the attitudes in place, and I think a representative of the attitudes backing the endless war on terrorism. And here is the line: America is no mere international citizen. It is the dominant power in the world, more dominant than any since Rome. Accordingly, America is in a position to reshape norms, alter expectations, and create new realities. How? By unapologetic and implacable demonstrations of will. Now that to me is straightforward folly. Hubris carried to a point which is tragic, because we do not have that kind of power. And when I'm thinking about dissent, I think of pain. I mean, dissent has always been hard in this country. It never draws a cheering crowd. It's not popular. Paine was, as you know, writes the founding document of the American Revolution, Common Sense. But shortly after the Revolutionary War, he goes to England, and then he goes to France, takes part in the French Revolution. In England, he writes a book called Rights of Man, which and the British aristocracy declare him an outlaw, and he has to flee for his life. Then he goes to Paris, becomes a member of the French Assembly, and he argues after Louis XVI is in prison and the revolution, Robespierre, are arguing the point as to whether or not to execute him, guillotine the king and the queen. And Paine stands up and argues against that. He says, look, you've had a revolution. The argument is not with the person of the king. The argument is with monarchy. Why don't you be the first nation in the world to declare null and void the death penalty? For that remark, he is himself thrown into the Luxembourg prison and placed under the sentence of death by the guillotine, and misses it only by accident, by a few days. I mean, he is scheduled to die on a certain day in August, and the day before he is scheduled to die, the revolution turns against Robespierre, and Robespierre is himself, which saves Paine. But when he comes back to the United States, he's reviled because as a blasphemer, because he has written a book calling into question the authority of the Christian religion. And the United States is a very religious country, was then, is now, which is one of the reasons that Bush has to sell the war, the endless war against terrorism, as a religious crusade. And John Adams describes Paine as the insolent blasphemer of all things sacred and transcendent, libeler of all that is good. And Paine is not allowed to be buried in the United States in hallowed ground. He's buried in an equivalent of a ditch in some property in New Rochelle. And throughout the 19th century, preachers all over the country would refer to him as Old Tom, which was a synonym for the devil. And when some people wanted to, there came a moment when some of Paine's admirers wanted to maybe place his head on Mount Rushmore, and Teddy Roosevelt, who was the head of the commission as to whose head went on Mount Rushmore, dismissed Paine as a dirty little atheist. But Paine would have recognized the government now in Washington, I think, as what he was protesting against in common sense. A government federalist in its mistrust of freedom. I mean, the passion for secrecy and on the part of the administration, and its mistrust of freedom, its mistrust of individuals, which is also evidenced in the USA Patriot Act, to me is awful to behold. Imperialist in its bluster, evangelical in its worship of property. In the White House, we have a president appointed by the Supreme Court. In the Justice Department, an attorney general that believes that God wrote the Constitution. And in Congress, a corpulent majority that on matters of tax and regulatory policy votes its allegiance to the principles of hereditary succession and class privilege. I'm just getting started. Sorry. But the well, that's the right time. Okay? My last point, the point is that dissent is always hard. Tocqueville knew that. Twain knew that. There's a wonderful debate in 1900 in Madison Square Garden between Twain, who is the head of the Anti-Imperialist League, a man in his 70s. He wrote against the Spanish-American, against the Spanish-American War, and then against the American occupation of the Philippines, and couldn't get those writings published during his lifetime because the editors thought they were unsuitable in a time of high and patriotic feeling. And he has this debate that is going on, I wish it was going on more vividly now than it is. But in 1900, Twain is arguing what I take to be the democratic position, not for war, not for the American empire. And on the other side, the best-selling writer of the day, best-selling writer in America in 1900, is Winston Churchill, who's 23 years old. And there's a debate between these two men, one of them in his 70s, the other in his 20s. And it's the same argument that we're now having, and it's the same argument that we had during the Vietnam War. And I just wish there was more of the argument. Thank you.